The EPOS Podcast, the scientific podcast of the University of Innsbruck Research Area, Economy, Politics, and Society. We bring together scientists to explore and reflect on how economies, political systems, and societies develop and change.
Can a tax on CO2 emissions encourage people to adopt more energy-efficient behaviors? Do laptop repairs cost more if you mention that your insurance will cover them? Will a paper with a famous scientist's name receive better peer reviews than the exact same paper authored by someone unknown? Questions like these are studied by researchers in behavioral economics, often through complex and costly experiments. Their findings have far-reaching implications for how we act as consumers, how we plan for the future, and how we build trust in institutions. At the University of Innsbruck, working under the umbrella of EPOS, the Research Center Innsbruck Decision Sciences is generating results on even broader questions. It combines contributions from researchers around the world with advanced digital methodologies. Joining us today are two professors of economics at the University of Innsbruck who can tell us more about that. Michael Kirchler is professor of financial economics and head of the Research Center Innsbruck Decision Sciences. Markus Walzel is dean of the Faculty of Economics and Statistics and deputy head of the research area EPOS. Beyond their shared involvement in EPOS, they also collaborate closely within the research unit Credence Goods, Incentives and Behavior. In this episode of the EPOS podcast, we'll talk about their shared research interests, the work of Innsbruck Decision Sciences, and what projects they've got lined up. Hello, Michael. Hello, Markus.
Yeah, good to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation.
So, Michael, first question. You said you want to catch your students' attention with experiments that show what behavioral economics is all about. Do you have an all-time favorite that you can share with us?
All-time favorite? I have, in my opinion, I have a couple of favorites, but one could be the following. I start with the question. So how does a ranking influence our risk-taking? So the level of risk that we take. And we ran a study with financial professionals from around Europe and students. And for half of the people, they just took investment decisions, risk-free or risky asset, over a couple of periods. And the others did the same without knowing what the others doing, but they were in a ranking with five others. And then we investigated, does risk-taking, investing more in the risky asset, differ when there's a ranking compared to not? And it did, especially with the finance professionals, those that were towards the bottom of the ranking, they took more risk because they wanted to climb up. And that's something I think that applies to many other fields as well in our daily life.
So Markus, if we look at something like that, what implications does this have on a national level, like if you look at financial health of a country like Austria?
Well, on the one hand, it means, or one of the implications could be that whenever an industry like the financial industry is very much driven by very competitive incentives, right? A lot of competition, that this has implications on the way the professionals make advice or give advice to their clients. And it also might have implications on who actually selects himself into that industry. And actually, I think you also have some evidence with respect to the latter. And that is something that does affect the way the whole financial sector works, and thereby also has an enormous influence on how the economy works. Because if the decisions are not just driven by the preferences of the clients, not just driven by their needs, but also are driven by competitive concerns of those that advise the clients, then you might get biases in the way investments are taken and financial resources are allocated.
So if you want to elaborate a little bit more on the personality traits of investors, was this something you looked at?
Yeah, so together with our team, so we looked at individual characteristics of people in the finance industry versus the general population. So us, and we found that on average, financial professionals in trust games or in so-called dictator games, they kept more money for themselves and gave less to the other people compared to the general population. And in general, as Marcus has said as well, they are more ranking driven, and competition is more important for them. And finally, they take more risk in experimental decisions and probably also in real life. And this impacts to a certain degree, as Marcus has said, probably also, that's what we find, how they invest money of their clients.
So if we have a result like this and the results are robust, Marcus, what do you say? Do they really influence policy in Austria?
Usually it's a long way from results like that to a kind of hardcore influence on policy making, because with the results that we've just discussed, it's also not completely clear what the direct impact would be. So I mean, one of the possible routes could be that you say, okay, if there is this selection bias in the finance industry, that might also be, for instance, a reason that groups of the society that are known to be less competitive, are known to have less willing to take risks, also do not select themselves voluntarily into that industry, which actually also gives rise, or could be one of the reasons behind the gender bias in that industry. And then, of course, you could pick up measures that try to get more equal opportunities in these industries, and thereby also affect decision making. I think that might be the most prominent channel in which there are some attempts to react to these competitiveness, mm-hmm. and perhaps also the selection bias in the finance industry, right?
So this example is perfect for showing how positively behavioral economics could be influencing the policies we have. There is this understanding also that behavioral economics could be used in another way if it's misused by people with special interests. What do you say about that?
If it's misused, probably we could refer to nudging, which is a very famous term to invent nudges to get better decisions of people, so that people make better decisions, to put it in the right way. So this was the original idea of nudges, to with simple messages or of changes in the choice architecture, that people make better decisions for themselves. But as you said, this could be used by companies or by institutions that, let's impose a nudge that the people make better decisions for us. And that's not what a nudge is all about. So while there is a lot of positive things when it comes to behavioral economics, because we take daily decisions, hundreds, thousands, and if we know a little bit more about what decisions we take and what we should do better, it's good. But here we have to be careful that nudges should be good for the individuals and not for big institutions and companies.
Yeah. What you mentioned now is really comparing well to some experiments that are done in social psychology, and I'm wondering how much in your daily work do you have overlaps with the colleagues in such fields?
Quite a lot, I would say, because psychologists do very similar research compared to us. So we have a similar method, a lab experiment, a field experiment. And when it comes to climate science, for instance, there's also a lot of synergies between psychologists, but also with people in climate science. So there is a lot of synergies, if a team is open for using those synergies, between us and other scientific fields. Marcus has mentioned the medical profession earlier. So again, it would be great to have more collaboration in this field as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would strongly subscribe to that. I mean, recently I heard one colleague saying that basically what behavioral economics did in the last couple of decades was that it told us that human beings are not perfect robots, right? I mean, because the individual in standard economics is perfectly rational and a very, very has very specific goals and is perfect in reaching those goals. So behavioral economics kind of teaches that, okay, this robot is kind of faulty every now and then. But still, this is not really looking at the individual decision maker as a human being, because a human being is somebody who's also driven by his or her experiences. And that's something that neurology, that areas of psychology do know very well. Mm. Right? If you have a traumatic experience, we know that that changes the wiring in our brain. And these are approaches that only start to become relevant in economics, that you really start looking at the human being rather than different versions of robots with different degrees of faultiness.
Mm. Yeah, you want
that's
to add
a perfect
to that?
Example. Maybe I can add just a few sentences on that. So a very simple example is we take hundreds of thousands of decisions daily. And quite some of those decisions have impact on third people, so on other people, be it familiar decisions or in a company or social decisions. So that's why it's so important to learn more about how we behave and to also learn a little bit what can I improve to make better decisions for myself and also for the others that are influenced by what I'm doing. So it's an everyday, it's about our everyday decisions, so to say, to a certain degree.
Talking about the faulty human, we are also faulty lab rats. So in your experience, how much do we lie on questionnaires when asked about our moral compass when making maybe also financial decisions? Is this something you have to deal with a lot?
Yeah, it's so cheating and lying are interesting fields to study. Also, especially when cheating and lying is related to earning money. So the more one can earn, that's what studies show, the more likely is that they cheat a little bit. So they don't say the truth or ignore something. And for instance, we had a recent study where we investigated the impact of competition, so we are in a competition or not, on moral behavior. And then we had the idea, it's not me and Marcus doing the study, we as a team open it to the entire globe, so to say, with a research question that teams, researchers, can submit proposals on how they would measure it. And they programmed the experiments. So competition, yes, no, impact on moral behavior. And we ran those studies with more than 20,000 people. And we find a slightly negative effect that competition has a negative effect on moral behavior, that once we are in a competition, moral behavior is reduced.
You found enormous heterogeneity.
Yes.
In the designs and also in behavior, right? And and therefore, I mean, that's more of raising questions rather than providing answers, because it really tells us that it's very relevant to have these big research collaborations that really look at certain types of behavior at a global scale, because the heterogeneity across the globe and also the heterogeneity within a society is enormous, in particular when you look at honesty, when you look at moral behavior and these kind of expressions of preferences, so to speak.
So you're referencing this different designs approach
yes.
you're doing at your center, Innsbruck Decision Sciences. Can you tell me more about the methodology? How are you really set this up?
Yeah, so one example was the one that I just gave, that it's not us designing one way of investigating a research question, but we have this research question, and we invite the scientific community to make proposals from the field. And as Marcus said, it's so interesting, and we and the community learn so much because we see this heterogeneity on how scientists define competition and moral behavior and how it influences the results. So we learn a lot. And I think it's important to do much more of this research in the future. Another way would be that it's not about designs, but we have another research question again. So, for instance, on financial markets, how many professional and non-professional investors invested over the last 2 decades, just as an example. And then we also, again, so we had data, and we did not analyze the data ourselves, but we invited more than 300 international financial scientists on doing that. And as Markus said, the heterogeneity in the results with the same data on the same question was extreme. So we find, for all questions that we asked with this data set, significant results in both directions, so negative and positive. And that's not bad. It's just another way, another next level to go deeper and investigate what are the best analysis path that we can take to make science even more better, even better.
So this reaches far beyond just being about economics. Do you understand correctly?
Yes, it's very inter and multidisciplinary.
Yeah. When Mike was presenting that research at a research summit of the entire university, there was immediately starting a debate about, okay, in my discipline, that doesn't happen. For instance, our former rector, a physicist, was then claiming that that's not something that bothers physicists. And another physicist said, no, but look, there was this period in the early 20th century where exactly that happened, that the same data had been analyzed and interpreted in very different ways, also in these kind of exact sciences like physics. And I mean, the attempts to look at the heterogeneity of analysis is something that also bothers many other sciences. I mean, in particular in psychology, I think also psychology is one of the fields that really pioneered that type of research. But I mean, most disciplines, I think, do themselves a favor if they look at the heterogeneity of analyses, because, yeah, as you said, it has the same order of magnitude as the statistical uncertainty that comes just with the data that you acquire. So it's something to take serious, completely independent of the research question or the type of field that you're looking at.
And final point, it speeds up the knowledge generation process massively, because it's not our team coming up with the design or analyzing the data, it's dozens or hundreds of researchers doing the same at the same time. So there's much more brain power involved, and we learn much more of it.
And regarding publication, how are your experiences with that? Who publishes this sort of research?
Yeah, it's a very new field. So it started, I would say, 5-6 years ago. And now a few of those many analysts or many design studies have been published. And the interesting thing is that mainly the general science journals like Nature, Science, PNAS, they are extremely interested in that because they see this novel uprising road. And also researchers like it a lot. They are also co-authors. So we have papers with more than 300 co-authors, which is great because there's more brain power involved compared to just me. But some, as Marcus has said, are still some kind of critical. So especially the younger generations is more into it. So some people or some groups that do the same since 2 or 3 decades, they are a little bit reserved in what they're doing. And up to now, it's a couple of hubs around the globe that are doing it. So Innsbruck is one hub. And there are a couple of others, and it's so inter and multidisciplinary, which is great for us and for the participating teams, because we learn a lot from each other. It's simply good.
So while we're talking networks, I mean, at the heart of EPOS is this idea of forging such relations. How are Innsbruck Decision Sciences influencing EPOS and vice versa in that way?
Well, Innsbruck Decision Sciences, I think, is the, to my assessment, perfect example of a research center that kind of gathers around a common research methodology, brings together people that therefore have very similar questions when it comes to how to do research and what kind of obstacles to get out of the way. And particularly, it also gathers around a certain infrastructure for the analyses, for conducting experiments. And I think that's always a very good basis of getting people together. To my experience, a better basis than to try to meet on a particular question. That's also nice, and if it's work, if it works out, and I think we had the pleasure of working together on similar questions in a team with some interdisciplinarity in the past. But I think that's much more complicated. It's much easier if people meet on the same methodology. And Innsbruck Decision Science meets on this experimental behavioral methodology, and that helps the research focus, the focus area EPOS, a lot to have one kind of more integrated group that gathers around a particular method.
I guess that setting up such designs on a global scale involves a lot of programming. You mentioned mathematical models. In these past years, digital innovations happened so quickly with the rise of LLMs, for example. So what are the new things you're most hyped about for conducting your research? Is there something you would mention?
Yeah, so those projects are amazing for us as a team because we have to administer everything. So from making the call to over pre-registering, the analysis to writing up the paper and making the data open, everything has to be done. What we are currently very interested in is, if we run online experiments, that not artificial intelligence bots are part of our experiments. It has to be humans. And at the moment, we are currently programming a software package that tries to investigate whether this is a human or an AI bot at the start of the experiment, that those AI bots are kicked out. This is extremely important and also, I think, problematic to a certain degree for some of those online research and public opinion companies, because they have to check it as well. And that's something that we are very much interested in at the moment, and we have a very good, so our team members, they are currently programming a very good software for it to know, yeah, it was done by humans, I mean the experiment. So
this is also very like a service to the whole scientific community, as I understand it, not like only
exactly. So our younger colleagues, they are currently writing on a study, making the code public, where they analyze how to kick out those bots. Of course, they have every couple of months, they have to redo it, because also the LLMs, AI bots, they learn. So this will be an interesting development among many in the future for us.
I mean, on the plus side, one of the big advantages of large language models, of course, is that we have new tools to analyze also more open questions that we can ask in experiments, that we can ask in surveys. Also, because that helps to get a better picture of the actual motives of individuals. If you just stick to very simple quantitative questions, then you might sometimes miss the point why a particular decision has been made under these circumstances in this specific way. And that's, of course, something that becomes easier if the text body of the answer to an open question becomes more readily analyzable due to large language models. I think that's another line of research that also within EPOS is pursued, in particular in the political science department, because they, of course, analyze a lot of speeches and that kind of stuff. But it's also part of one of the research projects that we just submitted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, would you want to tell us more about that? In our first talk, you mentioned that it's evolving around trust somehow. So what are the questions you're asking there?
Now, after we looked at credence goods, at trust, at goods and services that need some trust to be traded, we thought that one other thing that requires a lot of trust is science. And therefore, we now try to use the expertise that we hopefully acquired over these last years in order to also use it to analyze our own business, where, of course, also it's important that scientists behave in a trustworthy way and that institutions also promote trustworthy behavior and that incentives are set in such a way that trustworthy behavior is kind of the mode of that emerges or that is sustainable in our scientific community.
And maybe to add here, we also have a global perspective on that, because we try to investigate trust in science across different continents and countries, because there are already differences across countries when it comes to trust in science. And as a second point, we also check what do people trust in the classic study? So, for instance, of me, Marcus, and a couple of our team members with 500 subjects, or in the big, many design studies with 25,000 participants and 100 teams contributing knowledge, that's totally unexplored, and that's what we will do, among many other things as well, to see what's the impact on the trust level of people.
Will this body of research be open to collaboration as the other projects you mentioned?
I mean, we are 9 principal investigators, at least that's what we have applied for now, from 5 from Innsbruck, 4 from Vienna, from different institutions. And of course, we have our teams, so we hope to get more positions funded by that. And some studies, like the meta-science, the many designs, many other studies, they will be internationally run with dozens or hundreds of international researchers. And we are very much looking forward to the entire idea and project.
Yeah, and the collaboration stretches out to psychology, because some of the colleagues that we collaborate with in Vienna are psychologists, and also stretches out to political science. Mm-hmm. Exactly, because in the political discussion, that's where the trustworthiness of scientific advice, of scientific expertise is challenged those days. I mean, if you listen to Donald Trump's speech yesterday, then we know what is at stake when it comes to the role of facts in the political discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this affects people globally.
Yes.
To get it back to the individual level, one personal question at the end, because you gave us good examples of how humans are faulty. You know so much about it, about our biases, the different effects on our decision making. Do you take wiser decisions because of that?
I hope so. But of course, sometimes, or maybe often, or maybe somewhere in between, fall into behavior traps. But the good thing is, after decades of research on that and loving this field, is that quite often I realize, oh, once again, I trapped into this loss aversion or present bias problem, and so on and so on. And also talking with people, especially students, this is a great community in general to talk with, I realize when this is taught, and I teach a lot of it with simple experiments, they realize, oh, that's what I've experienced yesterday when I went to the supermarket. So it's a daily thing. And also students tell me that they start to learn in their daily actions that this bias or another one is at present and they can improve. And that's what I'm trying to do as well. And also this discussion with other people is so interesting, because sometimes they say, now I know why I always fall into this trap. Because, okay.
Yeah, I think it's one of those angels that stands on our shoulders, right? And just speaks to us and informs us about what a behavioral economist would do in a certain kind of situation that is known to be prone to some biases, but it's not necessarily the only angel, right, that is giving advice, at least to me, because I think that getting back to this point of being a human being, I think there are moments where you don't want to self-optimize, right, where you just want to be in the moment and where you also take the biases full on, right? I mean, I'm a musician, and I'm very interested in very good food, and these are moments where I mean I do know that I commit things that might not be perfect from a rational point of view, but I mean that's on purpose, and that's really out of the wish to become a human being that is not self-optimizing all the time. So that therefore, I mean, sometimes you can also kick off the angel on the shoulder, so to speak.
So,
and that's these are very good examples telling us that this is very interesting for the general population. So that's what I realized, and you probably, Marcus, as well, when teaching students and also when going to the public to have some third mission lectures for the general population. They often say, oh, it sounds so easy, because they trap into these experimental traps pretty often, and then we talk about how to improve it a little bit. And some people learn from it, and that's, I think, the great thing with our field as well, that there is a transfer possibility.
And sometimes it helps that you tell them that you also fail.
Yeah, of course.
Yourself. Sure. I think that's not the worst thing that you can do.
No.
Yeah,
thank you for this contribution to the third mission and this glimpse into behavioral economics. It was a pleasure to have you. Dear listeners, if you think the same, you might want to check out the other episodes we did on other research centers, and stay tuned for the next one. Thank you, too.
Thank you.
Thank you.